And welcome into another Saturday morning edition to Four's Company. Nick Keiser, Nick Frazier, Connor New, and Jake Lyman live from his hometown bedroom this morning. Glad to be back with you guys this morning. After a few weeks away, getting married on the honeymoon. And look, guys, I heard that I got some smack talk toward me a little bit, but hey, we're back.
I defended you. Just putting that out there.
Hey, I know you did.
You're gonna get the smoke.
Yeah.
You're gonna get smoked.
I got smoked because I wasn't here, but that's okay. Well, Jake Lyman, we got to check in with you real quick, my brother. How are you doing? Glad to hear from you a little bit before I flew home, but how are you up there in Virginia?
It's going okay up here. You might have noticed I wrote for our question of the day, worst travel experience. My car broke down right about midway from Nashville to Northern Virginia.
Wow.
And it is still in Bristol, Tennessee. So that's been the what's been going on the last few days, but it's good to be back home, celebrating my younger sister's graduation from high school later today. So,
man,
doing okay outside of what happened with the car.
How are we on the side of the road, Jake?
Well, so we pulled onto the highway and the check engine light started flashing and it went into kind of a limp mode is what I guess it was called. Like it wouldn't go accelerate over 1800 RPMs or something like that.
Right.
So we had to bring it to an advanced auto parts. They told us what the check engine light code was. And then we brought it to a Hyundai dealership. So we left it there overnight. It's still there. And had to rent a car to make the trip all the way back up here. So
I thought you biked.
We shall see what happens now.
Wow.
No. Yeah. We had to rent a car. So we will see, how long this takes. It needs a new engine. Might be covered. So we'll see. It might be covered under warranty. I guess this is an issue with a lot of cars like mine.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that I will be back in Nashville sooner rather than later.
Man. Yeah. Try to get those recalls. That's what you got to go look at. Man,
That's
the whole
what,
Hyundai. And all y'all know, I had a Hyundai, but now I got a Bronco. But look, I did not have a fun time with repairing my Hyundai whatsoever. So have fun with that.
Yes.
Man, that's nuts.
That poor orange Hyundai. We love that thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Maybe it survives and I'll be back with it at some point, but maybe we have to get a new car.
Man.
So
we'll see how that all shakes out, brother. I'm glad that you're with us this morning, though.
Yeah. Glad to be on. And that's our question of the day. Text or call. Let us know if you have anything that might make me feel better about my situation.
Maybe that rental. What'd you get for a rental real quick, Jake?
It was a Toyota Corolla. It was almost brand new. Only had like 1,500 miles on it. So that was that was nice.
Sounds like your new car, Jake.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Wow. All right. Well, we're broadcasting live this morning from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the 99 degree yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. So guys, let's dive into our headlines this morning. And if you don't mind, I'll share mine really quickly because it's similar to Jake. So in his whole situation traveling, and that's our question of the day, but I want to share a headline that I had based on my travel. So when I was on my way to Chicago the day after my wedding, we got delayed 6 hours to get there to Chicago, a connecting flight to get to Vancouver. So we get to Chicago, we run to our Air Canada gate, and they close the door to the plane, not the actual gate itself. So I thought, oh, I can still go on the plane, right? You know? So we get there and I'm like, please, for the love, let us on, please. And just this guy, his French-Canadian accent, I can't let you on, sorry. I was frustrated. And just my whole travel experience, they made up for it. Coming home was a lot smoother. Jake, I know I caught up with you when I was on my way home. It was just crazy getting back as well. Coming back overnight was what they gave us. So, man, that it was not a fun travel, but I enjoyed where I was and who I was with, obviously. But getting back in Nashville was priority number one as soon as I got back to the airport. So, but yeah, that was something that stood out to me as well. And then just kind of catching up on sports was something I've been doing all week long. Obviously, we're going to hit on a lot of Vanderbilt talk this morning. We'll talk about the Nashville Predators. Aria Garrison's going to join us as well from the Tennessean, who covers those Vanderbilt Commodores. And then we'll have Newt's Note. We'll end up moving over to a Titans minicamp as well this morning, talk about what we've heard this week, what we've seen in our own thoughts. But, Frazier, what is your headline this week, man?
Ooh, man, oh, man. My headline is I told y'all so because my Queensland all-star team out there in Australia for the NRL, they actually ended up winning.
Okay.
It's like a best of – yes, sir, thank you very much. It's a best of three series. They won 38-10 the other day over New South Wales. So, but overall, my Broncos lost this morning, so man. That was unfortunate.
Not the Ballyhoos.
Yeah, not the Ballyhoos, as people call them, Max. No, I'd say my headline probably is, I'd say Tennessee baseball. I still think Tennessee baseball has a lot to prove. I know people are probably thinking, what in the world is this guy talking about? Because they won yesterday 11-6. I mean, they were in a bit of a pickle yesterday. I don't know if y'all saw the end of that game.
Yep.
Bases loaded, no outs. They end up going 1-2-3.
Got lucky.
At the mound. They did. They got lucky. That's just how I perceive it. I think Evansville still has a little bit left in the tank,
mm-hmm.
and we'll see what happens in game two.
Yeah, well, it was a fun game to watch yesterday. Lots of college baseball was fun to watch yesterday. I ended up watching a game that I called for Robbie and Rex Red. My called shot for the win was to see West Virginia get beat. So that was a crazy walk-off last night for
that
sure.
That pitch count was unreal.
What was it, like 140?
140 something. It was like 144 or something
like
that.
Yeah, that's what I saw toward the end there. But that was an insane game to keep track of last night. Now, Newt, what is your quick headline for us this morning?
Real quick, mine's kind of the obvious one going around the basketball world, but the LA Lakers are in hot pursuit of two-time defending national champion of the UConn Huskies, Dan Hurley. I think I saw this morning news came out that the Lakers are prepared to offer him an 8x10 deal.
Wow.
So in the ballpark of $80 million, or $100 million, actually.
Yeah, that's – yeah.
$100 million, yeah. Which is, to me, oddly similar to what a certain team in Lexington, Kentucky that wears blue was prepared to offer him. And he said, no, I'm staying in UConn.
Man.
So I'm not fully convinced he's going to take the job.
I don't know either. I mean, his family flew out there yesterday.
Yeah.
So they were mulling it over. So we'll keep you updated on Dan Hurley in just that realm. Because to see a basketball coach and a football coach win the national championship and then move to pro sports, I don't know if that's happened in the last, 5 months ever going into a next season. So that's really interesting to keep track of as well. Now, Jake, you shared your car story, but what do you got for us this morning?
Yeah, just going off what Connor said there, I think somebody tweeted that Dan Hurley leaving for the Lakers would be like if Kirby Smart, after blowing out TCU, left for the Cowboys job or something like that. So something to keep an eye on there for sure. I think that would be a home run hire for the Lakers, but UConn would be left in a little bit of a tough spot. And their baseball team yesterday also lost 24-4 or something like that to Florida State. That was certainly an interesting super regional score. But I saw you wrote this in there, Nick. My headline is the Golf Channel interview.
Oh, man.
Oh, my goodness. If, for anyone who didn't see it, it was a course reporter. She was down on the hole for, I believe it was a collegiate tournament of some sort. And she thought that one of the assistant coaches was Vince Young, and went through his whole accolades and one of the greatest college quarterbacks of all time, six-year NFL veteran.
Yep.
What's the transition been like for you from football to golf? And he goes, I'm so sorry. I think you have the wrong person.
Yeah. And actually, I think if we want to listen back to it, I think Connor's got it pulled up for us. Connor? Oh, boy. Here we go. Test of the morning.
Vince Young playing this week. He's down with Lauren.
Dave, six seasons in the NFL, arguably one of the best NCAA quarterbacks of all time at Texas, picked up golf about 4 years ago. What's the biggest shift you make going from the ultimate team sport to now the ultimate individual sport?
Now, I apologize. You have the wrong person. I'm Everett Sands over at Citadel, which I'm a football coach. But the thing is, the great thing about golf is that I'm not only competing against myself, but I'm competing against everybody else.
This is your first pro-am ever playing, and what's the best part of being out here?
Well, being out here is a great thing, and having an opportunity to play with some professional golfers is a intimidating thing, but also a great thing.
Good luck this weekend.
Hey, I appreciate it.
My gosh, I'm sorry, I apologize.
Why does she keep going? I don't know. She really should have stopped.
She did do a great job of not letting it throw her off completely, because I'm sure in that situation, if you just completely get a guy's identity, misidentify somebody, I would have been thrown off completely. She did a decent job of sticking with it.
My thing is, I wonder if someone gave her that lead and goes and finds him based on description on a golf course. Because, you know, after I went to Valhalla, you know, it's kind of hard to find people. And I think when you point someone out, it's, hey, go talk to that person because they played in the NFL and they were really good in college. And I guarantee you she may have gotten a small lead where she kind of got tipped off about it. So I don't know, but that was a crazy thing to see happen this week.
He should have committed to the bit.
Yeah, I think so.
Yesterday on the Chase and Big Joe show, Chris Sanders came on, and he was talking about when he was at the Nashville Cats game. Somebody mistaken him for Derek Mason. Not R.D. Mason. Talking about MTSU.
Coach Derek Mason?
Really?
Yeah, it was hilarious. And Big Joe was there, and he was dying laughing.
Oh, man.
And then Chase ended up telling a story about when Derek Mason with the Midday Show was, I guess, at SEC Media Days or something.
Yeah.
And somebody, I guess, thought he was Derek Mason, the coach, and brought him over to, like, some sort of radio interview and was like, how do you think about the team this year? And D-Mac's like, I think y'all have the wrong guy. Oh, man.
Do you think Vince Young was in the vicinity?
I don't think so.
VY? Nah.
No, I wouldn't envision that whatsoever. But look, we have a lot to get into this morning. We have a full show ahead of us. We'll be getting into the Nashville Predators, what we've heard about, you know, UC Soros, the latest scuttlebutt that is there. We'll have Aria Garrison from the Tennessean joining us here at 9:30. She's going to talk to us about the latest with the Vanderbilt baseball program. Some coaching changes, by the way, so we'll get her thoughts on that. Newt's Notes will round out the hour as well. But our text line is driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, 615-737-1025. Call or text us here this morning on Four's Company. But coming up next, we'll hear from Elliot Friedman and his thoughts, what he could possibly think happened between him and his agent and the Nashville Predators. You're listening to Four's Company here on 102.5 and 106.3, The Game.
The one thing I say that I really stick to is that one of the reasons I think Soros' name got out in the trade rumors around the deadline this year, and at one time I said I thought it was about 50-50, is that if the negotiations had gone really well, I don't think there would have been any chance he was getting traded. And I do think the Predators and his representatives met and they talked about him being a Predator for life. And then when the two sides started talking about parameters of a contract, it wasn't in a place that Nashville was comfortable with. And it's all negotiation and, you know, you see what happens. And I understand the negotiations are rarely linear. So these things go on. I tend not to freak out about them. So when they brought up, could he wait because Shesterkin's going to sign a big number? I'm like, yeah, absolutely certain it could happen. But again, just because that is a tactic of the agent and what he should do, it doesn't mean that that's the way it's going to end up. And, you know, that's the one thing here. It sure sounds to me like Soros and the Predators would like to continue this marriage. You just got to get to a number. And Barry Trotz even said at the end of the season, like, don't be surprised if this goes past July 1st. So I think even he, like most general managers, is looking not necessarily where we are, but where we're going.
That was Elliot Friedman, friend of Caroline Willie and D-Mace, Sportsnet's finest NHL insider, talking about the latest on Predators goaltender UC Soros back here on Four's Company. Nick Kieser, Nick Frazier, Connor New, and Jake Lyman live from Virginia this morning. You know, I'm interested to see what this contract ends up looking like for the Nashville Predators and what UC Soros' agent, Kevin Epp, will end up trying to get, because could they ultimately wait all the way through
July 1st and go, we're going to take as much time as we possibly need, because some other goalies on the market are due for some contracts. And one that's most notable is Igor Shesterkin from the New York Rangers. So, Jake, I don't know how much you've been keeping up with what's been going on here this week at 102.5 with that whole conversation, but I'm very intrigued by what Willie had to say to Elliot about that, and then Elliot henceforth going on 32 Thoughts and talking furthermore about that. So what are your early impressions of what this could possibly mean for the Nashville Predators?
I mean, in all sports, in these contract negotiations, it makes sense to try and be the last one paid because everybody gets a little bit more. I mean, we're seeing it with the quarterback market. You don't necessarily have to be the best quarterback to get paid the most money. You just have to be the next one to get paid. So it makes sense for UC Soros to wait it out, see what Shesterkin gets in New York, and see if he can leverage a little bit more money out of Nashville. I know we talked about earlier in the offseason about how, you know, maybe the Preds end up trying to go away from UC Soros and build around Yaroslav Askarov, but it's starting to feel like Barry Trotz really wants to bring UC Soros back and extend their star goaltender. So it would make sense for UC Soros to wait it out and see if he can get that next contract, because again, it's not who's best, it's who's next.
Exactly. So my note that I made for myself this week in listening to that is, could UC Soros possibly be looking for, you know, around $8 million average annual? And I would tend to agree that that would be the case for a guy like him who was just making about $5 million per season on his last contract. So, look, I think he's deserved of a raise based on what he's done in the NHL. Now, I think this last season is going to be a huge indicator for their negotiations for sure. So, I think for the Nashville Predators' sake, yes, time is on their side. But, you know, sometimes when you play under the cloud of a one-year contract, that can really be a huge distraction for some guys. And, you know, UC said he hears about, you know, the scuttlebutt for being traded, or, you know, hey, when are you going to sign your next contract, man? Like, when that time comes, are you going to be able to be ready for that? And so that's been a huge question mark for him. And look, there are tons of players around the NHL that get asked that question all the time. But for the Predators' sake and for the fans' sake, I want to hear what you think as well. So please feel free to text us at 615-737-1025 and let us know what your impression is of what could happen this offseason. So, Frazier, you've listened to it all week long as well. What do you make of this entire conversation around UC?
Honestly, the Igor Shesterkin conversation with his contract before that, I'd say after all that gets dealt out, I think that's kind of what's going to kind of price out everything. I think that's kind of what, in my opinion, the Preds are kind of waiting on, is to see what that price tag will be. And I'm sorry if you already covered that, but like I think that's kind of what's going to set the market for Soros.
Yeah.
No. And if that is the case, then the Preds, I mean, would an 8x8 sound reasonable at that point?
I think it's reasonable for the agent to argue that for sure. You know, Kevin Epp has got plenty of high-profile agents that he is there for. And so for me, when I listen to what is going on in the NHL, and, you know, we all know the salary cap's going up, right? It's going up. So it could be something that is advantageous of the Predators to maybe bite the bullet and say early on, hey, we want to offer this. But if I'm Barry Trotz, I go, I have to know that my other ducks are in a row before I really do this. And so it's going to be really tough. And, you know, it's early to even mention this, but, and he's not proven, but Askarov will need a new contract at some point. And it's coming up quicker than most people think. It's within the next two seasons. And so you've got to get that done. So if you want to retain a guy like that, you're fine. You know, finding a backup goalie, that's not really the main issue, right? So, but I don't know what it's going to take for them to agree to it now. Like, if it happened in the next few weeks on July 1, I think they would overpay, quite frankly. Now, if it gets to the point of they're in, you know, right before training camp, and then maybe Igor signs with the Rangers and gets that done, You know, could the Predators arguably get that done before opening night? Absolutely.
What do you think that contract looks like with Shesterkin?
I mean, look, he could arguably be the highest paid goaltender in the NHL. I mean, he could get around $10 million. I mean, he could really, you know, push for a really good payday. And look at what the Rangers did this season in the regular season. Now, it's not playoffs, but you know, they lose in that conference final and don't make it against the Florida Panthers, and so they kind of, you know, crap the bed there, right?
How many years you think?
I think for a guy like Igor, and he's, you know, similar to Saros in terms of age. I think he's a smidge older than him.
Right.
I would argue, and I think even watching the Henrik Lundqvist series, the Henrik Lundqvist little, you know, docuseries when I was on my trip home,
right,
that gave me a sense of the Rangers love to lock down on goalies. I would say they could push for 8 years. Absolutely. Now, do I know what Igor's camp wants? No. But I've seen some reports that are 7 to 8 years for sure, that's what they would want, ideally.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Yes. But, you know, I'm open to whatever happens for him, because Saros knows he's going to be getting a raise regardless. So, I mean, if Saros gets somewhere near, you know, eight and a half, it's not going to shock me. But are the Predators going to regret signing something like that? And I even brought this up in the hallway one day with someone at the radio station and said, I could see signing bonus being a heavy influence on some contracts here in Nashville moving forward.
Oh, most definitely. And, you know, like, and Jake, I want your opinion on this too. Like, Willie and I were kind of going back and forth about this, and so is the Midday Show, about how much the true dollar goes in New York in comparison to Nashville. They made the dollar comparison. And, like, we all came to the assumption after doing research on different calculators, it's roughly about a $2 to $4 million buffer. So hearing about Igor, you know, just putting out an example, an 8x10, that would almost be, I mean, in a roundabout way, be the equivalent to an 8x8 for Saros here in Nashville, if that makes sense. Because, like, you'd have to spend a little bit more in New York to have that same life expectancy or, like, life quality with the dollar. Sure. So, Jake, what do you think about that? You think that's about the right round, that right number?
Yeah, and think about the state taxes, too.
Right.
I mean, mm-hmm. No state taxes in Tennessee, and they are absurd in New York. So that it makes a difference. We see it in the NFL. Guys want to go to teams who play in states with no state taxes. And I'm sure it's the same way in the NHL, where guys want to go play in Florida and Tennessee and Texas instead of New York and LA and Canada, where you're going to have to pay way more of your paycheck back in taxes. So it's that. And like you said, the cost of living in New York is, I can't think of the word. It is exponentially higher, I guess I would say, than it is in Nashville. So yeah, $10 million in New York is probably about equal to $8 million in Nashville, I would say.
It's a lot of $1 pizza.
Yeah. I look at it this way. Shesterkin is Justin Jefferson, and Saros is CeeDee Lamb. Now, Shesterkin is going to get a big payday. He's going to reset the market, just like Justin Jefferson did. That would make Saros the next guy up. So the question is, are you going to give him a similar payday or maybe even a little bit less, or are you going to let him walk and get it somewhere else?
I'm not sure. But, hey, we're going to keep that conversation going into our next hour. We'll have a little bit of Milwaukee and Predators talk coming up around 10:30-ish. So we'll see what all that turns into. But, hey, be sure to tune in to 102.5 The Game tomorrow for coverage of the Toyota Save Mart 350. Coverage begins at 1:30. With the race starting at 2:30. Coverage will also be available on 102.5 The Game app and at thegamenashville.com. Coming up next, we're going to talk about all the latest with Vanderbilt baseball with the Tennessean's finest, Aria Garrison. You're listening to Four's Company here on 102.5 and 106.3 The Game. Welcome back into Four's Company here on 102.5 and 106.3 The Game. Nick Kieser, Nick Frazier, Connor New, and Jake Lyman live from Virginia this morning. talking a little bit of Vanderbilt baseball with Aria Garrison this morning. Aria, so glad to have you on the program. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you?
We're doing great. Glad to have you on. So let's jump right into it here. Vanderbilt has made a couple of coaching changes, and so I know that you kind of broke down some possible assistant coach hires for Vanderbilt last night, kind of read through some of those options that you listed. Now, what are your early impressions of, obviously, Tim Corbin? He's not going anywhere. However, the assistant coaching staff is going to look different next season. What are your just your early thoughts on the changes, and then who could possibly fill that role?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the changes, frankly, needed to happen. I think that Vanderbilt had been one of the worst, consistently worst offenses in the SEC over the past couple of years, and that needs to change if they're going to be getting back to where they want to be, and especially in the postseason, like, having a good offense is the differentiator these days. It's kind of hard to know exactly what direction they're going to go, just because Tim Corbin has so rarely had to fire assistants. But in my list, I took a look at kind of three different types of people. I listed a lot of current ACC assistants. I think looking to the ACC could be a good idea to find some people who are proven as hitting coaches, who would probably relish the chance to join an SEC program. But I also, you know, there's some former players out there who could potentially be interested, and Tim loves to hire former players to be on his staff. There's also some people that have ties to Nashville or work for other local schools in the area, or they could look to hire from pro ball as well. And I think there's pros and cons to any of those approaches that they could take. But it probably comes down to, you know, who really wants the job and who has the best ideas of what they would do to kind of fix what's happened with this program offensively.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what they end up doing, Aria. So my next thought here for you is, and I was absent last week here in town, but, you know, them losing when they did, you know, how gut-wrenching was that loss for the program? And, you know, does that speak volumes more or less to possibly, you know, hey, maybe Vanderbilt's kind of fallen somewhat behind here with some other teams?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it speaks to the fact that the team this season was just not all that good in the first place. They were 13-17 in the SEC, and if they lost one more game than they did, they probably wouldn't have been in the tournament at all. During the regular season. Now, there was a lot of teams that were 13-17. You know, South Carolina, same thing happened to them, and they just fired their coach altogether, which is obviously not something that Vanderbilt should be doing or needed to do at this point. But they just weren't as good this year. And some of that was, you know, out of their control with injuries. And especially, you know, it kept during the regional, like that second game, Alan Espinal left after the first inning. Jonathan Vastine wasn't available. Like, those are two of their best players, and, like, that wasn't really in their control. But the fact that the team, you know, didn't really have a good offense and had really inconsistent pitching all year, that was on them. And I think it was further evidence that things needed to change in some way.
Talking with Aria Garrison from the Tennessee and talking Vanderbilt baseball. Aria, it seems like, especially in the SEC, there's been this shift where everybody's got these big power hitters who are putting up 30, 35 home runs. Charlie Connan's got almost 40. But Vandy has – they just haven't had that kind of player. Do you think that's something that will be a priority for Tim Corbin, or do you think that they can play their brand of baseball and not have to have that huge power hitter in the middle of their lineup to have success?
I think it needs to be something that Tim Corbin is prioritizing, just getting more power in the lineup. And there's a couple different ways you can do that. Like, you can have one guy that's hitting 35 home runs, or you can have a lot of guys who are hitting like 10 to 15, or you can even do what Kentucky did, where they had one guy who had 20, that was like their top guy, but then they just got on base and they hit tons of doubles, and they, you know, had guys with 500 on base percentages, and that works too. But you really, it's really hard to win without power, and especially in the postseason. You look at a team like Arkansas, they have the best pitcher in the country, arguably, in Hagen Smith, and they just were not particularly competitive in their regional, and it's because they didn't have guys who can score multiple runs with one swing. Mississippi State, same thing. They didn't have as much. They had a couple power hitters in the middle of their lineup. They didn't have as much lineup depth, and they didn't make it out of the regional either. And so it's sort of like almost a prerequisite to get out of a regional these days is to have guys who can hit home runs. And I think Vanderbilt needs to prioritize getting more of those guys on its roster.
Aria, kind of piggybacking off of your answer there, you know, with Texas and Oklahoma being the new additions to the SEC next season, do you believe that maybe Vanderbilt needs to look more into the NIL aspect of baseball here? And maybe, like you're kind of alluding to, about maybe adding a big bat to the lineup. Is the NIL on the market for Vandy, or is it just kind of stick to Vandy baseball and stick to what they know?
So they already have an NIL program in place where every player on the team receives an NIL deal that helps to cover the cost of their attendance. Now, a lot of schools already also do this, so it's not like they're not using NIL at all. It possibly might be worth, you know, looking into if a certain amount of money can help them land that big bat that they desperately need, that might be worth looking into. But I do still think that high school recruiting and getting guys out of high school is the most important thing that you can do as a baseball program. I don't think that you can solely rely on the transfer portal and NIL. You look at a team like LSU that is known for just getting the biggest name transfers year after year, but they weren't that good this year. And the reason they weren't that good this year is because the recruits that they got out of high school were not panning out the way that they anticipated. And that was the number one ranked recruiting class in 2022. And a lot of those guys just weren't that good. And they brought in these transfers, but without, you know, Paul Skeens, who, let's be real, you're not going to find another Paul Skeens in the transfer portal, like, ever again.
No.
Without Paul Skeens, you know, they had these transfers, they were good transfers, but without the high school players to support it, it didn't really work as well as it did last year. And so I think that ultimately, like, the transfer portal is a good thing that you can use to help you, but you need to build the foundation first in terms of players that you're getting out of high school. And Vanderbilt needs to be recruiting more power out of high school and not just trying to use the transfer portal to get that, because, you know, that can run you into a different type of trouble if you're relying on that.
We're talking to Aria Garrison. Aria, Vanderbilt was kind of underrated in the aspect of great pitching this season, you know, Bryce Cunningham and Carter Holton. Do you think adopting kind of a small ball style of offense similar to Kentucky would complement that pitching well and lead them to good success?
Not necessarily. I don't think it's really related to the style of offense that they play. I do think that the ballpark can play into it a little bit, because Vanderbilt plays in one of the more pitcher-friendly ballparks in the SEC, in the sense that it might be a little harder to hit home runs there than it is at a park like, you know, Tennessee or Georgia. But, you know, I don't think that the pitching is really related to what style of offense that they play. And other than in the sense that, like, you know, it's always good for your offense to be able to practice against high quality pitchers that, like, Vanderbilt has, and for the pitchers to be able to go up against really high quality hitters. But I don't think that it really, you know, makes a big difference to the pitching staff. I think that pitchers are still, you know, big time pitchers are still wanting to come to Vanderbilt, whether it's transfers or high school players. So, you know, I think that as long as that's still going on, then it doesn't really matter what offense they're playing.
Aria Garrison has been our guest here on Four's Company on 102.5 The Game. Aria, great stuff. So glad that you could join us here this morning, and have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too.
Awesome. Well, that was Aria Garrison from the Tennessean. Keep track of her. Follow her on Twitter as well. She does a great job analyzing what is going on with that baseball program. But coming up next year on Four's Company, the latest edition of Newt's Notes. We missed out on his nutrition as well. So we'll get to that coming up next here on 102.5 and 106.3, The Game. Welcome back into Four's Company here on 102.5 and 106.3 The Game. Our latest edition of Newt's Notes with our man at the desk. Connor Newt is with Nick Frazier and I, with Jake Lyman up in Virginia remote this morning. So without any further ado, Connor, what do you got for us this morning?
Well, first off, hi everyone. You can finally see me for Newt's Notes for the first time in Four's Company history. But I got into a debate this week, and it got kind of heated, but I'm curious to hear your opinion on this. Do bubble championships count? Let's take a look. You know, let's just revisit all of the champions that won in the bubble era. Tampa Bay Lightning, Alabama football, Los Angeles Lakers, Los Angeles Dodgers, Baylor, I guess, men's basketball, I guess you could throw in there. Do those count? To me, no. And I'll tell you why. All of those I listed, granted men's basketball played a full season, but all of those I listed did not play either a full season or a team that played a full season. Alabama, for instance, played a 6-win Ohio State. The Tampa Bay Lightning played, what, 50 games in a division that wasn't their own? The LA Lakers, they did play a full season, but they played in a bubble with no fans. The Los Angeles Dodgers played, what, 40 games? They lost 55-60% of their season and then played with no fans in a World Series. To me, it just doesn't mean as much, nor should it. It should it count, and if it does, granted, it already has an asterisk next to it, but we really need to just I need a definite answer on this.
Okay.
As we I need a win for once.
Well, I would say why do you feel so compelled that it doesn't matter?
It doesn't mean as much to me, you know?
Right, but you still had to have sports come back at some point.
Right. And that was pivotal in us getting through COVID and everything, but it was not true sports to me.
Well, but if it wasn't true sports, why were they able to play and then also play a postseason? If you play in a postseason and you're already going through an entire season of something, you know, there's been lockouts, there's been, you know, pandemics back in the early 1900s, you know, that actually happened where they had to come back and they had to finish out that season and a champion was still awarded.
Yeah.
Now, is there an asterisk by what happens? Yes, absolutely. I think to an extent you have to recognize the significance of that era for sure. But I'm curious what you guys think too. That's interesting.
And I want to open this up to the text line as well. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, for sure. 615-737-1025. I don't know.
Jake,
I mean,
what do you think about it, Jake? We better lost Jake.
I don't know. Maybe.
I'll just answer it right now. Honestly, it's kind of hard to like really put a finger on it, but I'll say this. I'm with Newt on this. Those little bubble tournaments, they don't matter. The NBA bubble, to me, that doesn't matter.
No.
Honestly, the only reason why the NBA bubble like championship mattered at that point was to give LeBron validation to win a championship for the Lakers.
Yes.
It's the only thing in my
yes.
opinion.
Yes.
The conspiracy.
Okay, so let's do this. Let's go through each one and rank which one means least to best. To me, the one that means the absolute least is the World Series, because that was what? How many games was that, Frazier? That was like a 50-game season.
They played 40.
Yeah. 40?
Yeah.
There's Jake. Jake, what do you think about this?
I had myself muted. I'm sorry.
It's all right. Pulling a Joe Rexroad.
I'm not used to these Zooms yet. I think it depends which one you're talking about. Like Connor was saying, like I think you can rank them in terms of legitimacy. And I think the Dodgers for sure is the lowest. Like that's 75% of your season that's gone. There's a reason they play 162 games.
Yeah.
I think Alabama would probably be the other one that I kind of question. Like, yeah, Ohio State played six games that year.
Credit
I don't know
to
if
Alabama,
you can really
though. That I don't think anyone was going to beat that 2020 Alabama team. That was the team with, you know, was it Tua or was it Bryce Young? I think it was Tua.
Pretty sure it was Tua.
But that was like Jalen Waddle and Devontae Smith and who was the running? Najee Harris was the running back. That team was unstoppable. Will Anderson was on the other side of the ball. That team was unstoppable. But
yeah, that was a good team. And Devontae Smith winning the Heisman as a receiver was impressive that year.
Yes, but a 6-win Ohio State team. Granted, they came in and beat Clemson, but I mean, that Ohio State team was good. Don't get me wrong, but that just limits the legitimacy. I mean, to me, but if you're in a championship game, you should play more than six games. That's just how it is.
Well, but look, guys, they're limited with what they had to play with anyway. Now, was there a lot of controversy surrounding the format and when they actually got things done? Absolutely. And I thought it was even strange in the NHL as well. But I do think that the NHL is higher on the list. Obviously, it's not the bottom two that you want to end up talking about because they still look. I mean, here's the reality of what they had to go through. They were stuck in two different locations in a hotel for almost months on end, about 2 months. And then they also had to play games with no visitors. They could not leave that said bubble. They could only go to practice and go to their hotel rooms and eat with their teammates. That was it. And that's what some of these other programs and teams had to do as well. I still think it matters because they got to play. Now, was it under the cloud of COVID and having, you know, the 6 feet standard and everything that we know now? Does it matter that they have to do all that and they still played? I think it matters that they went through it, honestly. I think it really makes a big difference that they even got through any part of playing any sports.
To me, it's just the Stanley Cup playoffs is one of my favorite playoffs. It's similar to March Madness to me in the fact that anyone can win. If you get hot at the right time, you can go a long way. And to me, when you take – granted, I mean, I know there was no – this was forced. It was a forced hand. You can't control this. But when you take away fans and you take away home environments and especially like those Canadian arenas, you look at it now, Edmonton, they're loud. Anyways, but you take that away and – it just takes all the fun away. Similar to March Madness. I mean, we can go to March Madness and Baylor and Gonzaga. I mean, it's pretty clear those were the two best teams in the tournament, but and they played each other, and it was a great game. But it's just, to me, it has to be, for it to be legitimate, you got to play a true, authentic season, to me. And you have to, I mean, fans are obviously a factor as well in stuff like this. Like,
it brings an environment factor.
Environment.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that's not all the poster board people in the stands. You know, I remember seeing that from the Titans games on those broadcasts. That was pretty funny to see, honestly.
As a spectator, like watching those games when there was nobody in the stands for like baseball or hockey or soccer or whatever it may be, especially soccer when I watched international, you could hear the coaches talking to the players on the sideline.
I kind of liked that too.
Yeah, and it was super cool. It was like being mic'd up, except not really.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the only benefit out of those weird times.
And the broadcasters didn't like it either, obviously. Yeah. You know?
Back to his initial point, though, like, yeah, all those have asterisks on them, but at the same time, they don't mean anything to me. All those championships during that era to me just don't mean nothing.
Yeah. Jake, real quick, is there something that you liked watching during that COVID year when teams actually made it to the postseason?
I got to say, during COVID, I remember when NASCAR came back and it was the only thing on. I watched way more NASCAR in my life than in like a month long span than I did probably the rest of my life combined. so that was fun to watch even with no fans, but you know, looking at these, like you see the Dodgers who have been so close to winning championships. And then the only one they could win was the COVID year and the Lakers too. Like since they got LeBron, they've kind of been a disappointment except for the COVID year.
Right.
It is a little strange that those teams haven't been able to repeat that success since then. So I think there's an asterisk next to all of them. It's just at varying levels depending on how much of the season you actually played.
Yeah, for sure. Mutt on our text line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, 615-737-1025. Mutt says, the Lightning won back-to-back the following year seemed like some validation for them specifically, which is ironic because their first championship was followed by a lockout. So, yeah, I mean, there was a little bit like fans didn't like that when it happened. So, you know, Mutt does kind of have a point there for sure.
Was the 2021 season shortened as well?
No, I mean, it was a little different with when
it was like hybrid.
When it stopped and started,
yeah.
You know, some of those teams had to get back. Like this offseason, I was telling this to someone the other day as well. This coming fall is when things are kind of back on the same clock as they usually are. So we're finally kind of caught up, which is kind of wild. And then also 2409 says, they're all Mickey Mouse titles.
Yes, that is correct.
So there you go.
To Jake's point, though, before we go to break, he's absolutely right about the Lakers and Dodgers.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
To the point where it's almost like their roster is, I'll call it short-fused, where they can only win a certain amount of games in a certain amount of time, where it's easier to just compartmentalize your body and recover. Mm. Like, for example, the in-season tournament for the NBA this past year, who won it? The Lakers.
Yeah.
Because they were resting guys during the regular season and then going on to play, you know, everybody, they're big name guys during this tournament
right.
to win a championship, which is it's a money grab to me. Like I just don't see it. And so
what's that thing you always say to me?
Money.
Everything is money driven.
Everything's money driven, man. That's the world we live in.
It is. Well, we're going to be talking Titans mini camp coming up here at the top of the hour to kind of change gears here on Force Company. But I want to readdress our question of the day as well. So we'll get to all of that coming up here after a short pause in our program. But looking forward to seeing what we've got in terms of action with the Vols as well, because they won last night as well. But hey, also purchase your tickets now for the Music City Grand Prix at the Nashville Super Sweet. Excuse me, the Nashville Super Speedway Friday, September 13th through Sunday, September 15th at the MusicCityGP.com. As the racing station, 102.5 The Game, has a special offer. It's for a limited time, folks, so be sure to use the promo code GAME for a 20% discount now through June 16th. You're listening to Four's Company here on 102.5 and 106.3 The Game.